The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. This week, Ed Miliband gets David Cameron on the back foot over benefits. But heaven knows he needed it after a week in which the bad blood was coursing through Labour veins. We take a step back from the daily ups and downs and ask, is Ed finally inching ahead? And as the reforming of the NHS reforms continues, we ask whether chaos could give rise to catastrophe for the coalition. I'm joined by our social affairs correspondent, Randeep Ramesh, our columnist, Jackie Ashley, and also by the most affable voice of the Tory grassroots, Tim Montgomery of Conservative Home. Now, politicians are always wary of the word relaunch, but Ed Miliband could hardly avoid one this week. After the Ed Balls papers re-sparked the old TBGBs between Blair and Brown, the victory speech never given by the brother that Ed defeated mysteriously found its way into the pages of The Guardian. The fight back started with a reasonably received speech on responsibility on Monday and continued with a strong showing at PMQs yesterday. Here's Miliband in the Commons.
How can it be right that people with cancer, 7,000 people with cancer, are losing £94 a week?
We are using precisely the same test as the last government supported. All we see here is a Labour Party desperate not to support welfare reform and trying to find an excuse to get off supporting welfare reform. Anyone who is terminally ill gets immediate access to the higher level of support, and we will provide that to all people who are unable to work. That is the guarantee we make, but he's got to stop wriggling off his responsibilities and back the welfare reform he talks about.
Let me tell him what Macmillan Cancer Support says. Many people will lose this benefit simply because they haven't recovered quickly enough. Mr. Speaker, I ask him the question again. Will he now admit that 7,000 cancer patients are losing up to £94 a week?
So, Jackie, a clear victory at last, but boy, did he need one.
Well, he certainly did. I mean, I don't think we should make too much of the individual weekly performances at Prime Minister's questions. The fact is, he started off very ropey, then he got a bit better, and I think he was improving quite a lot until last week when he did very badly, and now he's done better again. I think the trend is going in the right direction, but I think that's not really nearly as important as his leadership in general. And I think he was rocked by these revelations of David's speech in particular, and as you nicely describe it, a return of the TBGBs and Ed Balls and so on. And I think there remains a problem at the top of the Labour Party in that people are not yet united around Ed. A lot of people still haven't accepted or got over the fact that David lost. David was robbed, as they still think. Ed Balls, I think, is probably still playing his own game and would like to swing in there should Ed Miliband fail. So that's a little issue for him as well. And I think he's got to try to bind the people in a better way than he's doing at the moment. I don't think he's bringing his top team together. And they're certainly not firing on all cylinders. So they've had open goals on an awful lot of things recently. And yet the front bench on Labour's side are really not scoring any goals, if I can use a football metaphor.
And you also just had this line, didn't you, in your piece, Jackie, about how if you can't persuade your own brother, it's worth...
Well, I do think that's an issue. The public don't know Ed Miliband very well, and I think all they seem to know about him is, oh, he's the one that knifed his brother. Now, I think it is time for a bit of reconciliation. I think both sides are hurt and cross, but I would have thought their mother over Sunday lunch could do something, perhaps. But I think it's time that David... I also think in David's defence, he's been quite good up to now. He's done nothing. He's kept out of it. But I think he must surely now be thinking, so what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Am I going to sulk and be president of Sunderland Football Club, or am I going to come back into mainstream politics, which is where I belong?
I love the idea his real passion's always been football. I'm not quite sure. Now, Tim, fight back or not, do you think after the last few days have some Tories started to underestimate Miliband a bit, or do you think he still remains the dream Tory choice of Labour leader?
I'm afraid he is the dream Tory choice as a leader. PMQs, as I agree with Jackie on this, so we may not have much more agreement on other issues this podcast, but PMQs doesn't matter hugely in terms of voter support out in the country. It matters to backbench Labour MPs, as William Hague's performance when he was leader of the opposition mattered to Conservative MPs. But why William Hague failed was he didn't do enough to strategically reposition the Conservative Party as a more moderate, compassionate party. Mm. It took really until Ian Duncan Smith's first draft and then David Cameron's full draft before the Conservative Party got back in the game. And Ed Miliband will only be a credible leader that will worry Tories when he has redrafted Labour's economic policy in particular. That's the biggest gap at the moment between the Labour Party and the public, is the sense that Labour can't be trusted to spend people's money wisely. And until that strategic decision is dealt with, and it's the most important and only thing really that Ed Miliband needs to change, Labour will struggle.
So you think it really is about policy rather than personality, the problem that Miliband has if he does have one?
Well, there was this sort of attempt by someone that in the tabloid press to paint Ed Miliband as Red Ed when he first became leader. Actually, focus group research that I recently saw from the Conservative Party actually sort of said that Ed was more in the public mind Odd Ed than Red Ed, that he was kind of seen as this unusual character for the reasons Jackie said, primarily about the conflict with his brother, but also this sort of Wallace and Gromit cartoon image that cartoonists have certainly made fun of, and various other aspects of his character. A life spent in politics means that he does have a personal disconnection, but that is, I think, small beer compared to the major challenges, which is getting the economic message of the Labour Party right.
And Randeep, I mean, interested to know how you think Ed's doing, but also just on this issue that he did pick out on benefits. Cancer's a pretty special word in politics, and do you think he's onto something in trying to identify an aspect of the cuts that the public just will not buy?
I think there were two things. One is that he was better briefed than Cameron, and that came out pretty clearly. And secondly, I think that there is an element of fairness. There is this argument between the two political parties about which can be seen to be more fairer about cuts, and they both, to a certain extent, accept the need for cuts, maybe just not as many as the other side. So, and I think with that particular subject, where you had charities aligning themselves with Miliband, and also the general public seeing this as completely unfair. I mean, I've paid in to the state into an insurance fund, effectively, and that's supposed to look after me when I get ill with something as serious as cancer. The word cancer is actually quite important, because cancer, since 2000, has become the buzzword in social policy. If you want to win an election, tell somebody else that they're going to ruin someone's life's chances on cancer. And I think we've seen that with NHS reform, that cancer has become the way in which the parties connect with the public over a core emotional issue.
You see, Randeep's saying there that it depends on how fair you can be about cuts, but won't the public spot in the way that Tim's suggesting that it's easier to look fair about cuts if you're also claiming there don't have to be so many? And I wonder if, Jackie, quite a lot of members of the public think there have to be a lot of cuts.
Well, I rather wonder if a lot of the public think there have to be cuts, but not to do with me, please, and also not affecting the most disadvantaged and the sick. And I think that's the problem. And I think that's why so far there's not been as much opposition as you might have expected to the cuts, because people are talking about them. Cuts in principle are fine. We all know the deficit needs to come down. It's when you're actually seeing, oh, it's my granny whose carer no longer comes in to cook her a meal anymore, to help her get washed, or it's so-and-so whose cancer treatment has been drying up. Then that's when I think people actually see what the effect of the cuts is, and that's when I think there will be more protests. But I mean, yes, of course Labour need to get an argument about the economy and what went wrong on their watch, but I still think the argument the government cutting too far and too fast is going to chime with public opinion.
And this morning, Tim, Ed Balls is out at the LSE making a big speech about the economy and floating this idea, not traditionally a very Labour thing, of tax cuts rather than higher spending to stimulate the economy. Do you think that will make life a bit harder for the coalition?
I don't think so, because, of course, when Labour were in office, they had the big VAT tax cut, which was partly designed as a measure to stimulate the economy, but was also, in a typical Brownian way, you know, meant to sow division within Tory ranks. You know, we're offering you a tax cut, and George Osborne, David Cameron won't. And I think the Tories are, you know, there are many misgivings that Tory MPs and Tory rank and file members have about the way that George Osborne and David Cameron lead the Conservative Party. But there isn't on this issue of cutting the deficit. It's when I ask Tory members in opinion polls, are you happy to accept compromises on Europe and immigration and crime, things that motivate many Tory members, if the deficit is fixed? You know, you sort of get 80-90% saying yes. So I think Ed Balls is playing a political game. But you've got newspapers even like the Financial Times today, the economics editor, questioning where Ed Balls is going in this direction. Not a newspaper of the right, but orthodoxy now across most countries in the Western world is that the major economies are borrowing too much. And we're still not seeing Labour face up to that reality.
What do you think, Randeep? Is there a way to look fair without but also credible?
I mean, this I think that it's an interesting division between Labour and the Tories on this. And I think Ed Balls and George Osborne are quite similar in that they're inheriting the brown mantle of kind of being dominant in their parties by producing an economic narrative that's distinctive. With Osborne, I mean, he's tried to make the case for the deficit being cut and quite drastically. The Keynesian response is, you'll get this wrong. You'll kill the economy before you put it right. And that's where I think Ed is trying to lead the Labour Party.
To be well-placed when it all goes wrong.
If I can just finish, because this is two things. You need to get your ideology right first, which is what I think Balls is trying to do. He's trying to set the moral compass of the Labour Party on economics and trying to say, this is what we believe in. Secondly, he's waiting for incompetence. He's waiting for the confusion and the incompetence that will inevitably flow from the way that the British political system does social policy and does economic policy. There are just too many conflicting interests. It's too big bang, all this stuff, which is why we've seen retreats and confusion in Tory policy.
Well, I mean, unemployment wasn't too bad this week, was it, Tim?
Well, the unemployment numbers were good, although I think it's too early to sort of claim victory on this. I think one thing that I think George Osborne lacks is a sort of a big fireside chat narrative where he says things may often get worse over the next few years before they get better. But I want to take on this idea that somehow that what we're doing in Britain, the coalition is doing in Britain, is a big bang or exceptional. Barack Obama in the USA is now proposing cuts that when they start will be faster and deeper than we are doing in Britain. Recent analysis showed that the average cuts in Europe are bigger than what we are seeing in Britain. And that's just not me talking as a biased conservative. That was sort of in these fact checkers that now look into these data.
But if you had the biggest deficit in the world and now you're bringing it down to zero pretty quickly, how can other people's cuts be as big when their deficit wasn't as big?
Well, a lot of countries do have as big as deficits. America certainly is of the similar order to the deficit we have. And it is not George Osborne. It is not the Conservative Lib Dem coalition that is the exception. The exception is Labour. Labour is one of the few mainstream parties in the world now that believes that you can year after year live beyond your means.
They're not saying that, Tim. They're not saying that at all. They're saying, of course, there's a need for cuts, but we just do it a little bit more slowly so we don't choke off growth and recovery. But I think that's a perfectly legitimate argument. They're certainly not saying we must spend.
Well, it is perfectly legitimate.
That's how the Conservatives have managed to portray it very cleverly, I might add, but it's not true.
It would be a perfectly legitimate position if the Labour were taking a grown-up part, getting around the table with the government, or just in the public square, identifying some of the cuts that they would make.
But yeah,
almost every time, it's oppose every cut that the coalition made. And I think that will play well for Labour in the short run. They'll get some sectional interest that will applaud them for it. But if and when, as I believe, the economy will be fixed by the end of this parliament, that's deadly for Ed Miliband and Ed Balls, because they will not take any role in fixing the economy.
Well, that's what it all hangs on, and that's what you don't know, and I don't know, and Ed doesn't know, and George Osborne doesn't know, does it?
You can have both things at once. You can have the economy fixed, but still have a policy framework in tatters. And I think when we look at the NHS and when we look at welfare, I don't know whether we'll see IDS and Lansley leading those departments come in a few years' time, because I think that the kind of conflicts that go between the idealism, if you like, of Lansley and Ian Duncan Smith and the sheer hard-nosed Treasury view, which is we need these things done now, never mind your fancy plans, I think that's where you'll see the idea of incompetence and confusion coming into the public's mind.
We'll come into the NHS properly in a second, but just one final question, Tim, on the kind of economics-y side of it. From Ronald Reagan to David Davis, we've had politicians of the right who've made this argument that the way to get down the deficit is to get the economy going by cutting taxes, and cut taxes, then all businessmen up and down the country will invest, and then everything will grow and revenue will come in even at lower tax rates. Now, are you saying that sort of argument and the demand for instant pennies in the pocket has now gone away because people are just so worried about the deficit?
I think, you know, there are two branches of conservatism. You know, there is the Ronald Reagan branch of conservatism, which emphasizes supply side tax cuts. And then there is this kind of Angela Merkel, Christian Democratic center-right view, which says pay down the deficit first. And George Osborne and David Cameron are definitely in the latter camp. Now, I am with people like David Davis and perhaps many on the left in thinking that although I'm 100% behind Plan A in terms of deficit reduction, I don't think George Osborne is doing anywhere near enough to get the economy growing. But that isn't about stopping necessary spending cuts. That is about modernizing trade union laws. It's about deregulation. It's about stopping some of the green energy requirements that are going to kill manufacturing industry in Britain. It's that sort of growth agenda that we need, but we have to live within our means, and few Tories will object to what David Cameron's doing on spending.
Well, by going on welfare, Ed may have wrong-footed Dave, because everyone had been expecting an argument about the NHS, as Randeep's just alluded to. Where the Conservatives might be pushing ahead on Social Security, they've made a huge body swerve here. The top doctor, Steve Field, was sent out to conduct a listening exercise, whatever that is, and he came back with a list of changes to the radical plans which the government was already halfway through legislating. He did this last week, and the following day David Cameron said more or less he'd accept all the changes. Randeep, now you follow the detail more closely than anyone. After the climb downs, does anything really survive?
What I think actually survives from all this is the triumph of George Osborne. I mean, George Osborne has actually managed to steal Lansley's plan. Lansley's plan was about liberating the NHS. It was about giving power away. It was going to create this sort of vanguard of GPs that were going to change and reshape the NHS for us. That's all gone. That's what's happened. And what's happened, what's left is a centralised NHS, albeit one that's kind of independent from the Secretary of State, but that's about it, really. And who's championing this is the top civil servant in the NHS, Sir David Nicholson, so much so that the...
A former tankie.
A former communist and Stalinist. If you have a Stalinist organisation, you do need a Stalin, is the joke in the NHS. And Osborne is getting his savings going to be delivered by Sir David Nicholson, who will ram through those cost reductions and efficiencies simply because he controls or will control that £60 billion worth of budget in 2013 as opposed to what Lansley wanted, which was virtually all of it in the hands of commissioners, or £60 billion.
There's a bit of an irony here, isn't there? Because they're still keeping the bits of the Blair-Milburn stuff about foundation trusts, independent bits of the NHS with, you know... bossy businessmen at the top who are able to kind of command their own little island. It's going to be quite hard to close some of those places down if they need closing, isn't it?
I mean, the problem is competition within the NHS does exist. Whether politicians can engage actors to act competitively relies on the fact they produce a mood music which suggests that's the right thing to do, and secondly, they have an exit strategy, an entry strategy for entrance. Those three things don't seem to exist at the moment. I think that Tim produced a very good list of winners and losers in the politics of all this, and he was right to identify Steve Hilton, Oliver Letwin, the dreamers of the Conservative Party, as basically losing out to the hardline realists, the hawks in the Conservative Party, who look at the deficit and say, this is our problem, this is what we need to deal with. It's not about the structures.
Interested to see that there are any winners at all, Tim.
Well,
there aren't
many winners, and I don't know if I'm allowed to mention the Daily Telegraph in this gathering, but you know, there's a very
a definite winner.
There's a very important, you know, article I think by Alan Milburn in that newspaper today, in which he says, you know, as a great Blairite reformer of the National Health Service when he was the Labour's Health Secretary, saying that he thinks the cause of reform has been set back by a generation. And I think Andrew Lansley's big mistake, in contrast to, say, someone like Michael Gove.
Mm.
Michael Gove really wanted to take what happened during the Blair years and it be an evolution, you know, on school academies and so on. Whereas what Andrew Lansley did was he sort of wanted this big bang change, and it frightened everyone. And it's a textbook example, really, of how not to reform a public service that people cherish. And I'm very pessimistic, and I don't think we can even make a judgment as to how bad this dog's breakfast of NHS bill is now, because it's yet to go through potentially a lot more amendments in the House of Lords. And I fear we're beginning to see some of the real problems of coalition government, just with the tuition fees reform, which started off as something that upset students, would at least save money for the Treasury and would have given more money to universities. By the time all the amendments had been made to that bill, it's ended up costing the Treasury potentially more. The universities aren't getting the money that they want to become world-class universities. And I fear that with the NHS reforms, once this process of negotiation and compromise is finished, we'll end up with a similarly bad bill.
Yeah, I mean, I agree totally. I think, first of all, I think you're absolutely right on tuition fees. That is a complete mess now. But I think you're right about this too. You slightly wonder why they didn't just stop and start all over again, because I think you're right. It was absolutely not the way you devised policy in the first place. I kept saying to people, why was Lansley allowed to do this, to put out such a massive change to our most cherished institution? And Cameron and Osborne seemed to let him do it at first. And you must correct me if I'm wrong on this, Tim, but someone said, oh, well, they both used to work for Lansley. Mm. So he's very much, you know, their boss. And so they let him do it. But catastrophic thing to do at the beginning of their administration.
I think you're right about that deference. And just very quickly, I agree with you. I wish they would start again. Mm. And I don't think it's beyond possibility that they will. I think if the things if the amendments in the Lords get so bad, I think that would be the excuse for them to say, these are wrecking amendments, they've spoilt the purpose of the bill, and we will start again. And
it's hard to see what happens to Lansley then.
I hope they're looking for that excuse.
Didn't you rather mischievously suggest that after the Olympics that his nibs, Lansley, would disappear, mm-hmm. replaced by Jeremy Hunt, just after he's placed the medals on some British cyclists?
I did say that. And I think Jackie's right that there is a sort of a pupil-teacher relationship that Cameron has with Lansley, that in the same way that Osborne has that relationship with Hague, they are deferential to those two members of the cabinet in a way that they dominate the rest of the cabinet, but Lansley and Hague have a sort of a freelance position. And you know, Lansley has failed to sell this reform in any way to any people. Lots of Conservatives worried about Andrew Lansley, but his big virtue was we thought he had the professions more or less on side, and he clearly doesn't.
It's extraordinary that he didn't try to get them on board first. That's what I find.
Well, he
so
did. That's the funny thing. For 6 years, he spent kind of cozying up to them, and
well,
then
exactly,
thought he could take.
Then he was taken by surprise when they all said, "Actually, no." I mean,
he thought they really loved him.
The reforms they've come up with now, Steve Field, who I think has done fantastic stuff. They're all quite sensible, but why they didn't consult him at the beginning? Well, I think quite a lot of them are. Yeah. When, you know, the halting of a lot of things.
Yeah, they introduce a lot more bureaucracy, which I can't see really passing the test of Conservative kind of ideology. It just doesn't seem right to me. And I think with Lansley, I mean, looking back at him, in 1992 he led the campaign for the Conservative Party. I mean, that's why he holds this exalted position within the Conservative Party. And he's a technocrat. I mean, he does understand the technical aspects of NHS reform. He's a poor communicator. And he's also, unfortunately, it's hubris before nemesis, this. I mean, he came in with the idea that there was going to be a full stop in Labour Party thinking in the NHS, which had sort of created this monstrosity. And I was going to present year zero to the NHS. And it just, it failed completely because of that hubris, that pride before a fall.
Tim raised an interesting point a moment ago about what might happen next, because there was a great sense that, if not on the policy, the politics had this week been diffused. Everyone had got what they wanted. But Randeep, you said to me, I think, earlier in the week, that with things like the power of this monstrous new monitor, as the regulator's called, everyone's been so worried about, it's sort of saying, you know, your duty is no longer just to promote competition, but competition and a few other fluffy things as well. And when we actually get to debating specific clauses, is the whole political deal going to come unstuck?
I think it will. I think I can't see, as Tim says, it's got to go through committee stage again. Now, it took 8 weeks the last time to get this bill through. This bill has supposedly substantially changed. Well, I can't see them doing it before the summer recess. And even then, the Lords, if they don't do it properly in the Commons will simply say, well, we're going to do it properly for you. And there are a lot more independent-minded voices who have a background in health in the Lords than there are in the Commons.
And they're already planning their wrecking tactics right now.
The Lords is becoming a big problem for the coalition, actually, and we all are very aware that the coalition is a coalition in the Commons, but it's a weaker coalition in the Lords. And we've seen the NHS bill. That was the real reason why the NHS bill had to be stopped. It's because George Osborne did the arithmetic and he knew he couldn't get it through the Lords. He knew the professions were opposed, which of course didn't help, but it was the opposition of the Lords. The Lords are also opposing the police commissioners, elected police commissioners reform. And also this week, we've seen one of the things that Conservative grassroots love most, which is, you know, the referendum lock, which was supposed to bind future
European Union.
Yeah, in the Lords there as
exactly.
Well,
so
time to abolish the Lords.
Yeah, and and because the government has made so many U-turns recently, you know, people are beginning to sense that if you push them hard enough, you know, these will buckle. It's a very, very dangerous position for a government to be in. And I think I think the unions are sensing it on the public sector, strike issues, and the government have to be very careful now and be very resolute, or they will find that they'll be pushed on issues that really matter to them.
Well, I'm going to buckle to the pressure of our old enemy, the clock, now, and say that's all for this week. So thanks to Jackie Ashley, to Randeep Ramesh, and to Tim Montgomery. The producer was Harriet Grant. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.